Thank you so much, Dennis, and to all of our presenters. This is Jenny again from Land O'Lakes. We're going to go now into the question and answer session. There's been an incredibly rich discussion and questions going on in the chat box, so thank you to everybody. We don't have a lot of time, so we won't be able to get to everyone. However, hopefully there's maybe an option that we'll be able to have kind of an online chat on another date that AgriLinks may also be able to host on this topic, and our speakers might be able to respond with some written responses to some of our questions as we group them. I do want to, before we go to the questions, just flag there's been a few questions regarding mycotoxins and aflatoxins. As Andrew mentioned earlier, AgriLinks has had multiple webinars, and there are a lot of resources on aflatoxins and mycotoxins in not just animal source foods, but all sorts of crops. That is outside of the scope of this talk. We do know with very good science from the World Health Organization that the global burden of disease of foodborne illness in animal source foods is primarily from bacterial and parasitic infections. So that's why we kind of chose to focus on the management strategies for those issues in these talks. So I encourage you to look at AgriLinks for resources for mycotoxins and aflatoxins going forward. Our first question that we're going to go to is for Hung, and he is going to ask him to speak to the data collection and how you address the issue of lack of data. For instance, is this maybe a reason why there's limited antibiotics in food of origin? Is that a data problem, or is it because you know there's data there and it's just not kind of coming out in what you found? So back to you, Hung.
Good evening again from Hanoi. This is Hung speaking. Thank you very much for the interest and question. I can see here some concern from colleagues about the data, lack of data in risk assessment. You see, as I mentioned from the beginning, risk assessment is not new to all of us, but in terms of implementation, application of risk assessment for food safety has been rather recent for Vietnam. And in this type of context, we need to really to adapt to the local context, but also to develop kind of new approach to conduct risk assessment. So coming back now to the lack of data, for example, we look for the data of meat consumption, for example, and specifically for pork in Vietnam. You didn't really have it for pork specifically. You have the meat consumption for every type of meat included. So in this type of things, you know, either we conducted ourselves the survey from the study site by, for example, you see a convening kind of focus group discussion to really involve partners and stakeholders of value chain to provide information for our risk model for that. The second question is about the low level of antibiotic residues in pork in Vietnam. That is actually the data speak themselves from our study. So I think that, you know, we need to make it clear here, in fact, the situation of AMR, antimicrobial resistance, is quite important and increasing in developing countries, including Vietnam. And that actually, we didn't deal with that in the framework of that study. However, the antibiotic residues seem to be quite low in our surveys. And I think that one of the reasons for this low level of antibiotic residues is, in fact, maybe the livestock sectors in Vietnam managed quite well from that side, but also from the vet services point of view, the withholding period for antibiotics treatment is quite nicely kept for this area of study in Hưng Yên and Nghệ An province, two provinces in the north and center of Vietnam. Over to you, Jenny.
Super. Thank you very much for that. Okay, the next question is for Sylvia. Sylvia, we have a listener inquiring about milk certification and if customers were willing to pay a higher price and how much did that price increase? And kind of trying to get to the question of balance between affordability of the product and product quality.
Thank you, Jenny. So yeah, that's a very relevant question. When the training and certification was implemented 10 years ago, the beginning, actually, that does not necessarily translate into an increase in price. The price of the informal sector is is very, very determined by the market. I mean, there's a very competitive market. There's so many retailers and traders selling raw milk that obviously a trader that might go through a training cannot allow himself to just increase the price. So it did not result in that. Whether people would be willing to pay a premium in terms of higher price for better quality milk, I do believe that in the long term they may. Obviously, it's all determined by the purchasing capacity of the customers, which in certain contexts is very low. But I mean, from our talks to traders, they seem to report that their customers were, you know, clearly happier with the quality of the milk that the traders were selling. The traders were very happy with that. They could see that the customers were sort of coming to them. So while it might not be immediate, so a customer might not be just willing to pay a premium, you know, after the training straight away, they may over time, when they get used to that higher quality and they learn to sort of appreciate it in the long term, then that might result in customers to be willing to pay very small amounts of higher price for that better quality raw milk. But that is something we actually didn't observe back then. So to me that is the key. I'm not sure that the second part of the question, if Jenny, you can repeat it, or will that answer what the question was?
I think you captured most of it. We can go on to Dennis. Thank you, Sylvia. This is Jenny again. Okay, so for Dennis, there was multiple questions regarding kind of incentives for producers to bring their milk to the collection centers rather than going through more informal channels. And what are the benefits for people that are participating kind of in the milk collection centers? And in that same vein, there was also a question regarding kind of these milk collection centers and how they're financed as standalone business entities, or where they get their kind of funding from, if they were part of the project or if they're going to continue on after the project. Over to you, Dennis.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jenny, and a very good question at that. Of course, this whole structuring of the dairy business has happened in the midst of a chaotic kind of environment where the whole country is only trying to rebuild across different sectors. So over the years, government has invested quite largely through different mechanisms on establishment of what we call the milk collection centers. And they have struggled quite frankly with the actual functionality of the MCCs, because the ownership is at this point with the milk cooperatives. So what you have seen, I would like to go back to that slide that structures the market. But what you have seen as I navigate back, I don't know if the host is holding anything. What you have seen is a mechanism that has been structured to be able to target incentives at different points, all the way from the producer, as you saw that quite clearly, helping the producer to understand the needs for their business to be able to improve, to be able to grow. So over the time of the project, what we have focused on has been mainly trying to package around the entire chain. Say, if you are a producer, you have received training, you have received the package of input, you have received proper extension care, and you feel obliged and connected to your cooperative, which is facilitating the provision of these services. And so what happens is the services around the milk collection center become the motivation for farmers, for producers to be able to enroll and supply their milk through this point. So it has been essential in our BBS training to emphasize service provision to the farmers, because that is the starting point. But on the other end too, the informal market, which is the traders around the different collection points that will usually cause people to bypass the milk collection centers, they are poorly regulated. They are not properly registered as business entities. And farmers always risk losing all of their produce. And over the years, they have seen the difference between working in a structured market through a cooperative, through a recognized trader, and long, you know, across the chain on the other end, a proper supply to a buyer who can guarantee payments. And in addition, what we have done is to structure finance within this same value chain. So a transporter who has a stable relationship with a cooperative is able to source funding from a bank or a grant from the project, or even a long-term kind of contract with a milk buyer to be able to supply this milk over a long period of time. So all of those incentives combine to help the farmer to see, to kind of weigh the opportunity to actually formalize, if you like. So what we call it is really more gradually formalized milk chain by providing incentives that don't necessarily outcome in the real sense, but nobody is actually forced to get into this chain. So in simple terms, the real motivation is a combination of pricing from the pool end, a combination of service provision, improved BBS services around their milk collection centers. That's a very important aspect. If there isn't any value proposition to the other end, to the farmers will gradually go away and end up with a trader who pays cash. Now, the last and most important, I think, has been the structuring of finance around this same value chain. So while you are achieving quality across the board, you are also achieving a lot of value addition to this entire business at different points. The processor is able to acquire funding to grow their purchases. They are also able to pay back in time to the supplier. The supplier is able to pay back to the contracted milk collection center, and so on and so forth. So there is a combination of forces that make the incentives across the chain. But as a project, our soft contribution, which is in the training, in the mentorship that provides both the cooperatives and the individual producers around the cooperatives to appreciate the long-term value in actual associated with this structure. I think that's the most important that I needed to say. Thank you. Over to you back, Jenny.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Okay, we're going to go to a few more questions, but in the meantime, we're going to pull up the polls for the kind of your voting on how the webinar went. The webinar is not over. We're going to keep on answering questions, but please answer those polls while you continue to listen. The next question is going back over to Vietnam. And Hong, is there anything that you could share about your experiences from working with the informal pork sector to mitigate the food safety issues since the order and command approach did not work? And was it because of ineffective enforcement of food safety laws and regulations?
Thank you very much for this very interesting question. I have to say that an Indian partner has been working a lot on assessment phase. So you can see some of the evidences in this assessment on health impact by eating pork, fish, vegetable, etc. Like I talked. We are moving now to a new phase of introducing kind of innovative interventions to reduce all this contamination, improve food safety in general in Vietnam, and that is actually part of the upcoming project SAPOC, so-called SAPOC, moving from Pricris, as I showed, to the new project SAPOC, funded all the way by ASEA. Experience by working with informal pork sector in Vietnam in particular, and in other countries, I would say that Indri has a kind of, experiences in different informal market in Africa and in South Asia and Southeast Asia. And I think that, the evidence shows the great issue of food safety in Vietnam now is really the risk communication issue in the country. I mean, consumers don't perceive very correctly the risk that they would have from consuming the food they buy. So, and also, we have also kind of, flowing up on by the media about the risk coming from food system. So I think that, we need to work more on that risk communication and improving the trust of consumer to this type of food. Some of the studies showing that, the formalizing market, like supermarket, doesn't need necessary lead to a very safe for food in some of the markets. So from the traditional way, like India said, we need to really help people to improve their food safety status in this informal market. And by that, for example, some examples showing that the training and branding things from really from the slaughterhouse to the market to make people aware that, you know, food is safer, but they need also to pay premium to get safer food, because in some of the case, you know, even you bring the safer food and that mix with the less hygienic food or meat, so that doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't create any incentive. So the intervention to what the incentive measure for that need to be promoted more and more. And finally, you are very right to say that the reinforcement of regulation is quite weak in developing countries. And for example, if you compare the human resource of you know, food inspector of the whole country in Vietnam, for example, is equivalent to the number of food inspector of Bangkok City in Thailand. So you see some drawback and weakness in the system for that. So I think that, you know, we need to really approach these things from both ways. In the long term point of view, I think that, you know, the reinforcement of regulation is particularly important for development in future. But in the meanwhile, we need really to find also solution like our speakers, other speakers talked about in the context of Africa or here in Vietnam, really to help people to improve the food safety. I hope that, you know, I can give some element to answer the question. Over to you, Jenny.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, we're gonna work on wrapping up, but Dennis has something to add from Rwanda, so we're gonna pass it over to him.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jenny. An important aspect I wanted to make sure to bring up is the restructuring of the market and cleaning up the milk has been strongly complemented with a program, a national primary production kind of certification process, which I think is something that Sylvia talked about. And in fact, it is adapted from some of the earlier work that IRI has done in Nairobi, and we adapted it for Rwanda in a way that these milk collection centers that are participating in the cleanup process are recognized, first of all, through the different incentives that I talked about, but also strongly through a national certification by the Ministry of Agriculture, which we call the Rwanda Agriculture and Livestock Inspection Service. So we have worked with the government, with the department, to develop a criteria for evaluation of these milk collection centers. And they are heavily packaged around the different aspects of milk quality, you know, right from the various platform tests at reception through into the business itself and how it is driven, the kind of value they provide back to the farmers, and all of that comes together to provide what we call a seal of quality certificate. So it combines a set of best practices across the board that are all aimed at improving the quality of the milk and also the quality of the business at the milk collection centers. And as we concluded the program at the end of December, we were privileged to witness the first certification event of 27 dairy businesses out of a network of about 77 milk collection centers that we worked with. We had 27 of them awarded national certificates, and these will last up to a year, the license, that will allow them to operate and earn an advantage over the others for trading in a product that is already guaranteed of high quality. And an ongoing compliance check will happen at different points during the year. And that for us has been a major success in the sense that it upgrades the primary producers to be able to trade, because in any case they were trading, but in this case to be able to trade a higher quality, higher value kind of product. And I wanted to be sure that we can allude to the fact that Sylvia raised something around training and certification, in this case from dairy business. Thank you. Over to you back, Jenny.
Thanks for Dennis. Thank you, Dennis. I think that's an important thing that you had to add. Okay, that everybody, that is that's it for questions. I think I'd like to thank the speakers again and AgriLinks. This has been a really valuable webinar. I think that the listeners have probably heard some really good examples from diverse fields and regions on how that both the informal and the formal sectors can play a role in this, and we need to find a balance kind of working with all along the value chain And watching the chat box, there's also been kind of discussion about behavior change communications and linking this to actually improve consumption of animal source foods to improve nutrition in the most vulnerable populations. So clearly this is kind of, we're on the edge of some cool new work, and I hope that we can continue to lead some conversations around this with our, with other partners, both here in the United States and around the world. So thank you very much to everybody. All of the resources are kind of available. I'm going to pass this over to Carla to wrap up.
On behalf of USAID's Bureau for Food Security, I would like to thank all of our participants for a really engaging chat today, as well as all of our speakers, Sylvia, Dennis, Hung, Jenny, and Andrew. Thanks to all.